Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. Today we will talk about healing the racial divide in America. Recently, young black men were killed by police in several incidents, including in Ferguson, Missouri, and New York City, sparking protests around the country. Why are there so many of these deadly incidents? Why are police more likely to use excessive force when dealing with African American males? What are the deeper issues at play? And what can we do to reduce the risk of injury to black males while respecting the fact that most police officers want to protect the community? Here today to talk with us about healing the racial divide in America is Milagros Phillips. Milagros specializes in transforming relationships between the races using a powerful approach that leaves participants empowered and hopeful. Her program, Race Demystified, A Compassionate Approach to the Healing of America, is a powerful tool that she's used at Fortune 100 companies, colleges, universities, and communities throughout the country. Ms. Phillips' historically grounded approach for looking at race gives us a new understanding of our current challenges, raises our awareness, and develops new approaches that help improve personal and professional relationships. Ms. Phillips was the founding executive director of the National Resource Center for the Healing of Racism. She has served as expert in residence for the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. She developed an approach for congressional conversations on race in Washington, D.C., and co-facilitated that program for 3 years. Milagros Phillips, welcome back to All Together Now.
Thank you so much for having me, Eleanor. It's a pleasure to be here, although I'm not really happy about the reason that I'm here. The last time we were together, we were talking about the Trayvon Martin incident. And so here we are again.
Yeah, so whatever lesson we were supposed to learn at the Trayvon Martin experience, we didn't seem to get it. So let's look a little bit here. You know, what's going on and what can we do to kind of deal with this issue seriously in a way that can stop it from happening again? Because I'm a big believer in prevention is such, nine-tenths of the cure. Let's talk first about the recent incidents and what they show about race in America today. So let's talk about Ferguson, Missouri was a big young unarmed black man, Michael Brown, was killed by a policeman, and the grand jury decided not to indict. That sparked an explosion of rage with looting and burning of the town. So given the work you've been doing, helping people have conversations on race, and looking at these current events from an historical perspective, what do you see in the Ferguson experience that's important for us to talk about?
Sure. Well, first, the first thing I want to say about the Ferguson experience is that a lot of the protesters are actually peaceful. We have had, there has been some looting, there has been some burning, but most of the people have really looked to have a peaceful protest in that town. But, you know, I want to backtrack a little bit and just talk about riots or what we call race riots in America, because America has a history of race riots. And if you say to someone today, what is the racial makeup of a race riot, the response for most people will be what they remembered from the 1960s and the 70s and you know, all these various things that have happened sort of in modern history. But prior to the civil rights movement, the race riots in America were actually white communities going in and destroying black communities. And you can see that in Tulsa, Oklahoma. You can see it in the race riots that happened in New York in the early 1900s and 1920s. 1919 was known as Bloody Summer because there were so many race riots all over the country, in Chicago and in various parts of the country that were really bloody. But they actually were characterized by white going into black communities and destroying them. And so there's those kinds of riots and looting and burning and so on and so forth. In fact, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, they completely destroyed a very prominent, very wealthy community that was known as Black Wall Street, and it was destroyed within like 17 hours.
And this is white violence on black
communities. On black communities, yeah, and the entire community. I mean, there wasn't a building standing after that riot in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
And what sparked those riots?
That particular riot was sparked by a young white woman saying that, or the community believing that a young white woman had been attacked or raped by a young man who was riding the elevator. And she was the elevator operator, and he was on the elevator because it was only, remember, it was separate but equal,
mm-hmm.
but there was only one bathroom that could be used, one restroom that could be used by African Americans, and it was in the top floor of this particular building where she was the operator of the elevator. And no one knew exactly what happened. All they knew was that this young woman was left behind screaming when he ran out of the elevator. And so the story went around that, you know, he hurt her somehow, and, you know, and mm-hmm. they were looking for him to lynch him. And it was just this craziness. But these kinds of riots, the riot prior to civil rights movement was characterized by whites going in and destroying black communities and black businesses and looting them and burning them to the ground and so on and so forth. So our country has a history of these violent protests. After the civil rights movement, some of the riots that took place in African American communities have been African Americans, burning their own communities and looting their own communities. But it's also important to remember that, like, with everything else, it's not everyone. And particularly in Ferguson, it's not everyone going in and burning and looting, but there are pockets of people who have done this. Most of the folks have tried to be peaceful because they're trying to respect the
including
family.
Michael Brown's stepfather was mm-hmm. out there whipping up the crowd and encouraging violence that night.
Yeah, at one point, I think it was after the indictment that he did that.
After the lack of the indictment.
The lack of indictment.
Right, exactly.
That he did that. Prior to that, the family was asking people to be peaceful.
Right.
And they went on the air many times asking people to be peaceful. And, I can't speak for another person, but I don't know how I would react if, mm-hmm. If it were my child that had been killed and I felt like something was, something that was wrongful that had been done in this particular case. If I felt that way, I don't know what I would do. So I don't want to judge them for that.
Right.
I'm not saying it was right or it was good or anything, but grief takes on a variety of forms. And that particular community is grieving. The thing to remember is that we look at these incidents as isolated from one another, but when people have such strong reactions to something, it isn't just about what's happening in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
It really is bigger than that. And usually it's historically larger. By that I mean, for instance, and I try to explain things when I do my workshop to people from more of a common perspective, because I have people that come to my seminars who don't necessarily experience racism on a regular basis, or they've never experienced racism. They're white and they're, so I need to be able to explain things in a way that more of us would have in common. So when we look at, for instance, if you had, let's say you had an argument with your spouse, okay, and you never really resolved that argument, and you talked about it, but you never really resolved it, and then you decided to move past it, okay? And so, 3 months have passed, and you're having an argument about something that's completely unrelated to the first argument. If the first argument is unresolved, you will bring that up. and say, remember when, and by the way, and everything else in between that your spouse has done wrong will come up in that argument, mm-hmm. okay? Let's say your friend is watching the argument, and she wasn't there when you had the first argument. She has no knowledge of the first argument. She doesn't know the history, right? So she's going to look at that argument, and she's going to say, Eleanor, what is wrong with you? You're overreacting. Mm-hmm. What is the problem? You know, and what you will probably respond is, you don't understand.
Right.
Okay? So when we look at these incidents that happened, we can't just look at them isolated from history. What is happening in Ferguson, what happened in New York, all of these things have a bigger history. So it's personal to Michael Brown's family. It's personal to Eric Garner's family. For the rest of us, when we look at it and we react to it, we're not just acting out of what happened in that incident. We are looking at it and acting out of an unresolved history of all of the slights, all of the abuse, all of the other stuff that's happened before that's never been addressed in a way that, let's say, I feel satisfied with. You know, going back to the argument, okay, your spouse may have been satisfied with the way that it was resolved. We don't talk about it anymore. It's over and it's done. But in your psyche, mm-hmm. in your mind and in your heart, that argument remained unresolved for you.
So in this instance, in terms of American history and the American experience, are you thinking that first argument is slavery and that we've never really gotten over it? I mean, we've ended slavery and, you know, we've had kind of a march towards greater freedom from that time, but we've never fully resolved that. Is that what you're thinking?
We've never really fully resolved that. We haven't resolved the Jim Crow laws. I mean, even looking at slavery, we never resolved peonage laws. We took them off the books, but the people who lost their families due to peonage laws, that wasn't really ever resolved for them. They told the stories to their, and just to explain, peonage laws were laws that said that you could beat a slave to death and not be punished. You could shoot them, you could do whatever you wanted to them, and you would not be punished because they were considered property, okay? So beyond that, we had then Jim Crow laws and separate but equal. So we've had a lot of things that have been a part of this country. We have had laws, we've had riots, we've had all kinds of abuse and terrorism that has never been resolved, particularly for people of color. And those stories weren't just stories that you told. They were stories of, well, this happened in my family, or it happened to the cousin, or it happened to the neighbor, or, you know. So the stories have been handed down from generation to generation. And so when you're looking at that, you're looking, when people are reacting that way, you're looking at the lynchings. You're looking at a lot of unresolved stuff that has happened. And so this is part of a bigger problem. So if you look at it as an isolated incident without context, it looks like, well, people are just rioting and looting and they're using this as an opportunity to make mayhem. Mm-hmm. When in reality, what you're looking at is unresolved anger, unresolved grief, unresolved pain, trauma that has never been resolved, and all of those things.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I can see that. I was struck in the Ferguson case, you know, again, just as in the Trayvon Martin case, there was a big gap in how whites and blacks responded to what happened in Ferguson. So blacks tend to think it's open season on people of color, police can get away with murder. And whites tend to think, if the police officer fired a weapon, he had a good reason to shoot. What do you think about the different response by blacks and whites to the Ferguson case?
Again, it goes back to feeling unsafe, feeling like, the black community feels like, I can't trust the police to keep me safe. Whites feel like the police is doing a good job of protecting them, because the police is doing a good job of protecting them for the most part. But in African-American communities, not all African-American communities, but a lot of African-American communities they don't have a good relationship with the police. It's not always the case, but it is the case in a lot of places. And so people feel like they can't trust, like the that system is against them, that that system will not necessarily stand up for them if they should need for them to stand up for them, and that the system is not for them. In fact, there is a phrase that people use in the African American community, and they say, oh, yeah, justice, you mean just us? In other words, it's just for whites. And so it's a shame that the expectation in so many communities across the country is that they will not be taken care of justice-wise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now let's turn our attention to the incident in New York City with Eric Garner, whom you mentioned. Eric Garner died from a police chokehold when he was stopped for selling cigarettes. Unlike in Ferguson, there was a widespread concern about the excessive use of police force in that incident. And in fact, it was across racial lines and across party lines. People thought that the police had used way too much force under the circumstances there. Why do you think they didn't have, there was such a difference in response to the New York City case versus the Ferguson case?
I think the difference is that we saw it. It was, we had a visual telling of the story. So in Ferguson, we had a discrepancy in what some of the witnesses say. And some of the witnesses said that Michael Brown had his hands up. Some of them said that he didn't. You know, there were some discrepancies in the way that people told the
story. It was like
story.
Three different experiences that you were hearing about.
Yeah. With the Garner case, we saw the video pretty much from beginning to end. Most of us saw that video from the time that Mr. Gardner was saying, you've been harassing me all week, just leave me alone. And then the other police came from around the back and grabbed him. Then several of them got him and tackled him to the ground. And then even when he was laying on the ground, he kept saying, I can't breathe, and nothing was being done to help him. And so we saw that. This wasn't, we can't put that in the category of hearsay. We actually saw what was happening. Mm-hmm. And most of us were traumatized by the experience of watching that, regardless of the color of our skin. Because the reality is that skin color has nothing to do with anything. Skin color doesn't make us any less or any more human. We're all human. And so we watch something like that, and we're traumatized by it. And we feel like it shouldn't have happened. There should have been a better way to take care of this than the way that it was taken care of. And this could be us. And, there's empathy and sympathy and all kinds of things that come along with the seeing of the event, where most of us did not see what happened in Ferguson. Mm-hmm. It's not to say that one person was right or wrong, because I don't know. I wasn't there. But what I do know is that watching this film just really it brought up emotions for people that they might not even had known that they had about this topic and about the way that the police reacts to some of these young men. It's really a pity.
Yeah, I find it instructive that there was such a different response to the two incidents. I think you've nailed exactly why that's so. But what that suggests to me is that in the first instance in Ferguson, people had a lot of unconscious response, that the unconscious response among the whites would be to give the benefit of the doubt to the police officer.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you saw the evidence, when it was clear that there was excessive force being used, that, you know, to our credit, we as a people almost uniformly said, that's wrong. Mm-hmm. That's unfair. That was just way more force than was warranted under the circumstances, and it led a man to unjustly die. So I find that encouraging, that mm-hmm. when presented with the actual facts of it, that almost universally people think this is wrong.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I think that that's, as you said, that that's hopeful. I think it's very telling of where people's hearts are. I mean, I also did read some very negative feedback and very negative stuff about the Garner case. So it wasn't all positive. You know, people were writing, I saw some writings on the internet about how he deserved it and he was a thug and all these things that had nothing to do with the facts of what we saw. We, mm-hmm. You know, but that, again, tells you where people are. And my work really is about seeing what's happening in the moment and realizing that it's always greater than that. And it tells us about where that person is in their personal growth, in their understanding of what's happening in their society, in their willingness to change. It gives us all kinds of information if we're willing to be open-hearted and open-minded. And it's important to understand that not everybody's in the same place at the same time.
That's for sure. And it was interesting for me just kind of witnessing my own response to these instances. So when the Ferguson thing happened, and then there was so much, my first response was, this is terrible that, you know, the police are there with force, with guns. Here's an unarmed guy by himself. He ends up dead. I mean, clearly something went wrong, and there seemed to be a misuse of an abuse of power in that situation. So I was really feeling that, and then knowing the context of how often does it happen that young black men or even older black men kind of enter some kind of situation with the police and they end up harmed or killed. So that was kind of my first response, like excessive use of force. But then there was, in the conversation that it sparked, I felt a lot of hostility towards police as a whole. And I grew up in the household with a policeman, and it was my father. Spent his life doing police work and security. And I knew him, and I knew the people that he worked with, and none of them get up in the morning and say, you know, I want to go kill a black man. Mm-hmm. They really don't. They get up and they wanted to help the community, to protect the community, and that's why they got into it. So I got concerned in some of the backlash to the instances that the police were being painted with another broad brush. I mean, mm-hmm. just like sometimes people paint people of color with one broad brush, you know, that's like, and it just seemed unfair. So it kind of, you know, held me back from wanting to join in the protests that were in my community going, well, what exactly am I standing for if I'm here? Mm-hmm. I mean, I want to stand for justice all around. I don't want black males to be unduly harmed by police using excessive force, nor do I want to participate in saying police be damned and, you know, you're misusing your power and need to be stopped.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just observing my own response from my personal story.
Sure, yeah. And I have kind of a similar story in that I had a cousin who was in part of the New York Police Department. She was a policewoman in the police department. And a brother-in-law who was in the New York Police Department that retired a few years ago. And so he was in it for the long haul. And And so you do look at that and you go, well, they're not all like that. At the same time, you know, we have to look at the evidence that's presented and judge everyone as an individual. And this is what Black folks try to do all the time. You know, people are constantly going, can you speak for your race? You know, just
right.
Speak for everybody kind of thing. And,
right.
And it's like, well, no, I can't. I can tell you about my experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I can talk to you about my family and my friends, but I can't talk about everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it is important to put it in perspective and to realize that people have a job to do. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I do think that we need to do a better job of screening people that go into the police department.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's extremely important. And I know that, you know, when you look at these incidents, these incidents are about fear.
Right.
It's about these members of the police department being fearful of the Black men. And, you know, so I have a tendency to just to look at things from a lot of different perspectives. And so I have a lot of questions about all of this stuff. Like, I wonder... if you're that frightened of another human being, is police the best job for you? You know, is it, is it possible that you might be a better fit somewhere else? I mean, in organizations, when we do evaluations of people and we figure out that, oh, no, well, you know, I know you want to go into sales, but maybe that's not the best job for you. Maybe marketing would be better, or quality control would be better, or something else would be better. Because a lot of the organizations who want to make a profit want to get the most out of the people that they hire. And so they're very careful nowadays about that. And they evaluate people and they go, well, you know, the reason you're not performing well here is because this is not a good fit. And so sometimes I wonder, how much of an evaluation is done for people entering the police department, do we need to look at this closer?
Right. I think that's true, and especially now where we have the militarization of local police. They're coming with all this equipment that taxpayers already paid billions of dollars for the wars in the Mideast, and they're bringing some of it home. And it's showing up in police departments. So now there's more and bigger weapons to be used. And I don't see that there's been parallel training along with that. So I think definitely whenever there's new equipment, new powerful weapon, there should be along with it the training. And you've got to exercise serious restraint because this is serious weaponry you're carrying around. So I think maybe some more of that along with some of the profiling, because I do know, I mean, having said what I said, I do think most police are in it for the right reasons, and they're
mm-hmm.
great people, and thank God they're helping keep us safe. At the same time, I do know there are some people in there, you kind of wonder, they were drawn into the job because they wanted to have more power, and they wanted to have power over people. They liked to carry the gun that made them, you know, be respected. And I think that there are some members of the police force who have that bully in them. They go from the schoolyard bully into the police force, and then we end up with some bad situations. And I don't think it's very many, but, you know, there are some. And I think if we had some of the psychological profiling of the police before they enter the force to know, is this the kind of a profile of a person that we want to be carrying a gun around the community.
Right, exactly. Yeah, very important.
So you talked about fear, which I actually think that's kind of the core of all of this. And one version of it is, you know, I know if I were the mother of a Black son, I would live every day in fear, wondering what's going to happen to my son. He could be out in the street, being perfectly, you know, doing nothing wrong, and he could get stopped by the police. He could get into some situation where he ends up either arrested or hurt. And I know you've got two sons, and I'm just wondering if you're willing to share kind of your personal experience. Like, what have you ever run into any situations with your sons and the police?
Yeah, you know, this is so interesting that you would ask me that. Some years back, my younger son is a musician, and he teaches. He goes, you know, to people's home and teaches drumming. And he was on his way to work, and so he had his cymbals in a backpack, you know. So he's got this big round thing on his back, and he was also holding the stand for the cymbal, and he was carrying that in his hand, and he's headed for his class, and he got stopped by a police, and he was close to our home at the time. He got stopped by the police. He was frisked because the police said that someone had just robbed something somewhere. We don't live anywhere near stores. Someone had robbed somewhere, and he fit the description of the person. And my son's a very gentle soul.
What's his name?
I'd rather not do that. But I can tell you he's a very gentle soul, and he's a quiet person. And so we laugh because he plays the drum, you know, because he's such a quiet person. So that this is his big loud thing, right? He was mortified.
Yeah.
You know, he was embarrassed. He in fact, he didn't even tell us for about 3 days.
How old was
carrying, he? He was, at the time, early 20s. I think he was 21, 22. He was carrying the shame and the pain of that, and he didn't even tell us because he just felt horrible about it. Horrible. Mm-hmm. Here he was on his way to work, you know, not even thinking about police or anything else, and he gets stopped, and he has to drop all his stuff, put it on the floor, and he gets searched, and you know, it was just horrible for him. My older son told me he's been stopped, and interestingly enough, they don't do drugs, they don't drink. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't even like to take penicillin when they're sick. I have to fight them to take penicillin when they're sick because they do not like drugs of any kind, whether they're prescribed by a doctor or anybody else.
And one son is a fitness trainer.
Exactly. You know, so they're totally into fitness, into exercise. My older son played football in high school and college. And, you know, so for them, this is just, you know, I mean, it's insane. It's horrible. I mean, fortunately, they know what to do, because you have to, like, train your children to know, you know.
Be prepared.
Exactly. And so, you know, they were close to a car, so my younger son said he had him put his hands on the top of the car, and he frisked them, you know, so it was pretty horrible. But even when I was a young woman, my ex-husband used to get stopped in New York by the police all the time. He worked the night shift. And so he used to get stopped and frisked by the police all the time. Mm-hmm. And this was in the 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sorry to hear those incidents, but it drives home to me just how pervasive this must be. And, you know, as a white person, I've never had that experience. So, but it's concerning to me that goes on.
Oh, yeah. I have a friend that has four sons. They've all been stopped. I mean, a lot. Mm-hmm. and her husband used to get stopped. You know, he's passed away now. But, you know, so it's just, you know, it's pervasive. It really is.
Yeah.
And so when you're looking at Ferguson, what you're looking at is people who have themselves or have had someone in their family been, you know, unfairly stopped, or have been frisked, have had some kind of negative experience with the police.
It's adding on to the history base. Now
exactly.
You've got your personal experience
exactly.
on top of it.
Yeah.
Well, I think one of the movements that's been hopeful, I think, has been more of the police forces saying we want to have a police force that more reflects the community that we're in. Mm-hmm. I was astonished to read about Marion Barry, who's the former mayor of Washington, D.C., who recently mm-hmm. passed, and that when he first came on the scene in D.C., how white the police force was, and actually a lot of the contracts from the city and everything were mostly going to white contractors, and yet the city at that time was very heavily black population. So it was one of the contributions Marion Barry made was to help integrate the police force and the contracts for the city and kind of spread it around more for the people who are living here. So I think that's helped when you have more blacks, more Latinos on the force. I actually think also thinking about having a police team that reflects the community, let's get some more women in there. I mean, I have noticed with every one of these incidents, it's been man on man. Mm-hmm. And I kind of wonder if those police officers were female, would there be the same rate of, you know, people getting seriously hurt along the way? So I think we need to kind of up the women in the police force, too. Mm-hmm. Do you think that would make a difference?
I hope so. I remember I told you I had a cousin, female cousin, who was in the New York City police force. And she had been, before she was a policewoman, she had been mugged. She was like 17 years old. She'd been mugged. And fast forward, you know, years later, she sees the man who had mugged her.
On the street.
She ran after him.
No.
Yeah. And he had a knife. And she tackled him and, you know, handcuffed him and took him in. Man was never hurt. He wasn't shot. He wasn't, you know, she didn't have to take out her baton. She just, you know, she did what she needed to do. And she arrested him. And so I often think about that story. And unfortunately, she was eventually retired because she was running after someone up a flight of stairs and her kneecap gave out. And, you know, so, but I'm saying that to say that, I don't know, maybe it would make a difference to have more women, but I have no idea what would make a difference. I think that, you know, looking at how I realize, and I always say this in my seminars, that when a person on the police force is confronted by another person and there's something happening in that moment, the police have to make a split-second decision.
Right.
But what I always remind people is that there really is no such thing. A split-second decision is made with a lifetime of conditioning.
Right.
And if the conditioning has been, those people are no good, they're bad, they're less than human, or whatever it is that the conditioning has been, if it's been a negative conditioning, in that moment when you have to make that so-called split-second decision, the only place you're going to go for your information to be able to make that decision is you. You can't ask your neighbor or your partner or anybody else. In that moment, it's you and that other person. And so if what you're carrying inside of you is a lifetime of conditioning that is based on these negative stereotypes, what you're going to sense from that person in that moment is that you're in danger. Not necessarily because they have a gun, like we saw Diallo in New York, who did not have a gun. We have, you know, but because in your psyche, what you have internalized is that those people are dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're reaching for something in their pocket. They're not reaching for an ID in your mind. They're not reaching for something to show you who they really are. They're not reaching for their passport in their purse. They're probably reaching for something to hurt me with because that's what the conditioning has taught me. So it goes beyond that policeman in the moment. What are we teaching people about other groups?
Mm-hmm.
What is it that we're putting out there that is being internalized as danger so that when people are faced with something, that's the first place they go for information? And I'm not saying, you know, there are times that we walk down the streets and we feel uncomfortable. You know what I always tell people about that? Because some people tell me, well, you know, I'll just walk in front of those people because I don't want them to think I'm afraid of them. And I'm like, you know what? This is why we have intuition.
Right, it's your internal radar.
Your internal radar is going off and it's saying danger, 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 and you choose to go down that alley anyway, that's on you. Really.
completely, you know, because you completely ignored the information that you have inside yourself that said, I'm probably, you know, I probably shouldn't go down that alley, or I probably should cross the street over here. It feels safer to me to cross the street. But we don't do that. If we try to be politically correct, right? And so we put ourselves in harm's way sometimes because we don't want people to think, well, you know, at that moment, really, seriously? You really need to be able to hear, you know, what's going on inside you. Now, if you're a policeman and you're hearing what's going on inside you, and what's going on inside you is these people are dangerous, then you need to find some way to take care of yourself, right? But then the question becomes, what does that look like? What does it look like for a policeman to take care of himself in that moment? And I just have a big question mark around that. And I'm going to talk about something that's probably very controversial, but I'm going to say it anyway. I think it's so interesting that we live in a culture that when we have wild animals that we feel in danger of, feel like they're going to attack us, we shoot them with a tranquilizer. But with human beings, we shoot to kill. That doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. None whatsoever. I have a big question mark around that. Because to me, you know, someone's coming toward you. And again, I can't speak from the perspective of a police person because I'm not. I'm looking at it from the outside in, you know. So I'm kind of safe over here. And I just go, well, just shoot him on the leg or in the arm or, you know, like, find somewhere else. You have to shoot them in the heart or in the head or someplace that's deadly. I don't, you know, but those are just questions that I have around the way that we run our system, the policing system. What does it mean to train someone, you know, you shoot to kill? What does that mean? And particularly if you know someone is unarmed, you know. So I just have a lot of questions about some of that.
Well, I think in most instances you don't, if you're the officer, you don't know if someone's armed or unarmed. And it's that uncertain. And then they need to, for the safety of themselves and the community, assume that the person
is armed.
Is armed.
Right.
So that would be kind of my sense on that. But I want to pick up on what you were saying about the conditioning. You just say that split-second decision-making is made with a lifetime of conditioning. And it's okay if I'm walking down the street and I get nervous about someone and I just say, well, I think I'll cross the street for my own safety.
Yeah, they don't have that choice.
Right. Well, the police officer is there to kind of deal with the situation.
Exactly.
So that conditioning, and that's kind of what I want to know is, how do we deal with that? I mean, you were talking about the legacy in the country, the legacy of slavery, the legacy of the, you know, the bias that's been around in many communities. So how do you begin to unwrap that? I mean, it just can seem kind of overwhelming. And where do you even begin to make that change so police officers can face those situations and not be hear trigger alert, drawing on all the negative bias that's in there, but actually facing clearly and cleanly the actual situation that they're in that moment?
To be honest with you, I don't know how we do that from here on in. What I do know is that what we teach people makes a difference in the way that they will react to the situations that they're in. So, for instance, we have some young people in Colorado, I believe it was, who were protesting because their history books had been changed. And there were groups that were protesting that the history books are too negative. They share too much of a negative history and that's not good for, doesn't make America look good. The young people were protesting because they were saying, we need to know the truth. Because if we don't know what's happened, the truth about our history, we're going to keep repeating it. Mm-hmm. So we need to understand not just the great stuff about America, because, you know, we get that, but we also need to understand where America hasn't been so great. And they were really, they felt that that was really important. They wanted to know the truth. A lot of what's happened is, we haven't gotten a well-rounded picture of the history of the country.
And a lot of the history we've gotten, particularly about African Americans and about Latino Americans and about Native Americans, has been a very skewed, very negative history. And a lot of the real history has been omitted from the books. And so so young people get this very one-sided story about what America is, what America has been, and so on and so forth. And here are these young people saying, well, we need to know the other side, too, because we need to understand it. If you just look at a single human being, we have positive and negative inside of us. You know, we work to be good people, but it doesn't mean we don't have shadow inside of us or times that we just go, you know. And so it's important for young people to understand that, because what happens a lot of the times is that if we paint this beautiful picture of how wonderful we are, how good we are, when a young person is confronted with their own internal shadow, they're going to think that there's something wrong with them. And
right.
They're not going to know how to deal with it.
Not just a young person, all of us.
Anyone, exactly. And we see that with young people particularly all the time, where they feel alienated and isolated because there's something going on in their psyche that's telling them, well, you're a bad person. You know, and if we paint a world for them where everything looks rosy and everything looks beautiful and everybody's wonderful, that's unrealistic. And so that person feels like, you know, there's something wrong with me if I'm not, you know, if I'm not rosy and pretty and have nice thoughts and positive thoughts all the time. We need to let people know that we are all of the parts that we see in our society. We have it all inside of us. That's why it gets acted out, so we can see it.
Well, and we know there's many great things about America, and one of the
Absolutely.
Wonderful things is we moved from that legacy of slavery into freedom and, you know, ever more freedom to the point we now have an African-American president. And not to say that means everything's solved, but that's incredible to see that. So
mm-hmm.
we have that side of America, which I love. And then there is, like you talk about, the shadow side. But people don't want to look at that. I mean, we're kind of in denial about it and going, well, yeah, well, let's stick with the American story of the ever-steady march towards freedom and not look at the continued expression of the shadow side. And so denial is just the easiest response. Let's just shove it under the rug and pretend it's not there.
Mm-hmm.
And also, and then speaking from my own personal experience, you know, as a white woman raised in Boston with a police officer for a father, and growing up in an all-white suburban community, we had one black family in town.
Mm.
So I was just like, you didn't have the experience for that connection and conversation, so then you don't know how to have the conversation. So, and I think that's actually one of the biggest problems. We keep having these incidents. We had Trayvon Martin last year in Florida with the Stand Your Ground guy, the neighborhood guy just up and shooting Trayvon Martin. We one after another with these black men ending up injured or dead, and we say, well, we need to have a national conversation about race,
mm.
and it is a topic of conversation in the news, you know, for days or for weeks, and then it disappears again. So I think there's a huge feeling of wanting to shove it under the rug and the denial, the discomfort around it, but I actually think having a national conversation, it could be good, but I also know I've been in conversations about race that were destructive mm. and that made it worse because it was, you know, people of color kind of guilt-tripping the whites, and then the whites either going, mea culpa, it's all our fault, or going, you're trying to guilt-trip me and I didn't do that. So I've just seen it kind of go in a negative way, too. But you have an amazing program, and I'd like to hear from you, how do we have a constructive national conversation about race? Where does that conversation begin? What are the guidelines? How do we get that going in a way that's positive and constructive?
I think that conversation starts around the dinner table. Mm-hmm. I think that people need to have open conversations on race in their families, particularly white families. Black families do it from time to time, but mm-hmm. I don't know that there are that many white families that do it. There are some.
Mm-hmm.
I think that then you move that conversation from the from around the table to the schools, to the community, to the workplace. You know, the conversation needs to happen everywhere. And I think that I'm glad you talked about guidelines. I think guidelines are extremely important. One of the things that helps with starting that conversation is, number one, understanding that people don't know what they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And that in having that conversation, people may say things that are awkward or feel awkward, even bringing some things up. I think that it's important to be compassionate when we have that conversation.
With ourselves and with others.
And with others, mm-hmm. exactly. I think that if we don't educate ourselves about what has happened in the country, we keep having the same conversation over and over and over again and
right.
thinking that we talked about race, but we really haven't.
That's what I feel. I feel like we're trapped in this Groundhog Day of
mm-hmm.
this police on black man brutality.
Yeah, it's very interesting. If you talk to people will say, I'm tired of talking about race, but they haven't really talked about it. It's never really been talked about.
Mm-hmm.
You and I are having a conversation now that's mm-hmm. taking us to a variety of places. You know, when people talk about race, they don't know where it's going to take them. It's like opening up Pandora's box, and people feel very uncomfortable with uncertainty.
There's that fear coming again.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's going to happen
if we open
this Pandora's box?
Exactly. So people will just say, I'm sick and tired of talking about this, or I don't want to talk about this anymore, or when are you going to shut up about this, or it seems like you blame us for slavery and my family just got here,
right.
You know, one generation ago or something.
We're
like
Irish
that.
Immigrants.
Like,
you know,
yes.
We were slaves once, too.
Exactly. You know, so people will bring up all kinds of things not to have the conversation. And it's interesting because for me, if you don't get some kind of information before you have the conversation gets stuck
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't lead to transformation.
Right.
Because really that's what we don't just want to talk about race. We want to have a conversation that's transformative, that changes things.
Right.
So we can't change what we don't understand. And for the most part, people don't understand race in America.
Mm-hmm.
It's really sad. And the reason they don't understand race in America is because they don't have enough background information.
Which is why I love your program. And we just actually have a couple of minutes. I can't believe this hour is flying by. I could go on for another hour. This is fascinating. But you have a wonderful program called Race Demystified, which I participated in, and it really was enormously helpful for me as a Boston Irish white woman coming from all that city had gone through to help me understand more about how to even talk about race. So why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about your program?
Sure, yeah. As you said, my program is very founded on historical information because I think that that's the missing piece. We don't get it in school, and I think it's important for people to have that background in order to have the conversation. We also talk about healing and transformation and how that happens in an individual, in a society, and in a country. And so that's really important. And we have guidelines on how to have a conversation, how to talk about race.
You have them?
Yeah, absolutely. I
mm-hmm.
mean, it's extremely important that we listen
with an open heart and an open mind when the person's talking about their story, because everyone's story is different,
mm-hmm.
and everyone's story counts, because everyone's story is part of the collective history of the country. And so so when people share whatever it is that they've experienced, it's important to listen,
mm-hmm.
and to listen knowing that they haven't had your particular experience.
So how can our listeners find out more about your work and take the workshop?
Sure.
Or?
Well, I have a program right now. It's a seven-month program. It happens only once a month, though. It's the first Tuesday of every month, and it's at 6:30. It's here in the D.C. area. And the program is called Race Through My Neighbor's Eyes. And it's kind of like a coming to the table type of thing, because we serve something for people to eat so they can come straight from work. They don't have to go home first. And that's a wonderful program. So they can contact me by writing to me at milagros@innergems.com. So that's milagros@innergems.com. I will happily send them all the information they need to attend the program.
Great. And just briefly to close out, what can the listeners do about healing race in America?
I think the first thing that people can do is inform themselves about some of this missing history, so that they can understand that things aren't happening randomly, that there actually is a context in which they're happening. So the most important thing that people can do is to read and to get books and to talk to their children about race, regardless of the color of their skin, because there really is only one skin color. It just comes in many shades, whether you have melanin, a lot of melanin, very little, or...
That's great. That's all the time we have. Milagros Phillips, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you.
And for all your great work.
Thank you, Eleanor.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. We want to thank our research assistant, Dr. Judith Singleton. I'll be back next week. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.